I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Michelle LaFlamme-Childs of the Santa Fe Art Institute. And a week from today, Thursday of next week, the open house, open studios is happening once again at SFAI.
That's right. Thank you for having me on.
And what happens at these open studios?
The open studios are an opportunity for the public to see what the artists and writers in residence do. It's really the one time we open up our most private program to the public. So people can come see the kind of work the visual artists are doing, hear brief readings by the writers, and really, in addition to seeing the kinds of people that come to the Art Institute, get a sneak peek into studio practice, which is really a rare thing.
And sometimes getting a sneak peek into that studio practice is incredibly enlightening for the artists of Santa Fe who
were
finding that people work with materials and things in an unusual manner.
It's really a great opportunity for networking, for seeing new work. There's a lot of reasons to come check it out. It's really fun.
Every time you come, you say, we have an incredible group of new residents. But it's the same every time. Every time they're incredible.
It really is. We were just talking about that in the office the other day. At the end of August, when everybody left, we started lamenting, oh, this was such a great group. And I realized, we say that every month. When they leave, we all go, oh, it was such a great group. It's really great.
So this is, once again, Thursday, September
24th.
24th from 5:30.
Yeah, it's 5:30. It starts with, we have one writer, so it'll start with a reading, and then we'll do little guided studio tours, about 5 minutes in each studio, and then we cut the public loose in there to chat with the artists at their leisure.
And eat refreshments.
And, well, yeah, stay for dinner.
Excellent. Well, the first artist whom we have with us today is Tim Haley. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And so you do work that is about motorcycle drag racing.
That's the current series of work I'm doing, but my work is all over the place in terms of what it looks like and what it's... I mean, it's always about life, never about theory, so that does sort of boil down in some respect, but you would often not know it was, you know, the same person at all.
You would often know it's not the same person at all. Do you work in different genres?
Oh, yeah. Like, right now, the series of work I'm doing right now is very large photos and video. But it's the first time I've ever shown either of those two things in a gallery. Well, I've shown video before, but usually as part of an installation.
Tell us about the motorcycle work that you're doing. How do you do the photographs?
Well, my day job is I put out a magazine about motorcycle drag racing. So I go to these races all over. And I've been doing it for about 10 or 11 years. And I started just writing at first, then taking pictures and shooting video. And I've always been struck by how my friends who are racers are very similar to my artist friends. They spend all their time and money on this absurd pursuit and you know, for mainly recognition within their own tiny little community. And
what's the pull of it? What's so compelling about motorcycle drag racing? What's it like?
Well, I've always been obsessed with motorsports, so it's hard for me to answer that part of it.
Have you done it?
I used to street race a car when I was a kid, but never even thought about going to the track really to race the way these folks do, although some of them race on the street too. But This is sort of an underrepresented sport, this motorcycle drag racing, and there's a lot of, I think, you know, one of the things I like to do with this series of work is show the people involved, and basically the photos are all candid portraits of the people at the track, the racers, and it's not the stereotype that people generally expect when they come.
What do people generally expect?
Well, they generally expect kind of a NASCAR-looking sort of thing.
And what do they get instead?
Come to the open studio and see.
All right. Well, on that note, yeah. Thank you for being
sure.
with us. You're from
My pleasure.
You're from Jeffersonville, Indiana.
Originally, yeah.
And where do you live now?
I just travel constantly. I know my stuff is in storage in a 2-car garage in Queens, and I just keep moving around.
Just producing this magazine.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, that keeps me traveling to races three out of 4 weekends during the racing season. And then, you know, I'll have exhibit at different places. And then sometimes I just like to go visit people.
So you actually live out of your car? I mean, you have no home address?
I have a well. I gave up my PO box that I had in Brooklyn because they did such a terrible job with my mail there. So, and I don't exactly live out of my car, but I use that to get around quite a bit, and I carry a fair amount of stuff with me. Yeah,
I
have an Astro van, by the way.
I think you're a man of mystery, and we're going to leave it at that. And people have to go see your work at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Sounds great. Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Josefina Monson-Giesinger. She is showing her work also at the Open Studios at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you are from Ciudad Juarez in Mexico?
Yes, Ciudad Juarez in Mexico.
Tell us about your work there and how you ended up here in Santa Fe.
Well, for obvious reasons, we have to move to the U.S., and that's how I apply for my residence, and that's how I get it.
For obvious reasons, meaning the situation of violence, especially toward women in Ciudad Juarez?
Well, not especially for the tourist woman, but let's say the whole meaning of violence in town.
Tell us more about how you experienced that yourself.
It's not a good experience to tell, but we had to move because we had freed. I don't know if it's the right word in English. They tried to kidnap us, so that's why we had to move.
Now, when you say us, you mean your family?
Yes, of course. When that happens, it affects the whole family you have.
This is a problem that's been going on in Ciudad Juarez for some time, but it seems to have gotten a whole lot worse in recent years. Is that correct?
Well, it began with the woman, the violence against women, which was a specific kind of group of women, okay, and not the whole society. But this went far, far away on the news, and it becomes like, generally speaking, the whole woman. But no, it was a segment of the society, mainly. But this is a little bit different because the violence is now related to the drug dealers or the drug movement, whatever it is. And this goes, generally speaking, I think right now it's at a peak point, but like everything, it has to go down sometime, and I really hope it goes sooner than what we expect.
So how does your work address these issues, if it does?
No, exactly the opposite. As I'm a local in that violence, even though I'm not related with it, I've been affected, I just want to try to show the opposite, which we have something else besides violence or women murdered or affected. We have also good people, artists, writers, art, real people that do something different than the violence.
So some of your work is affected by what looks like African art.
Not exactly African art. What I do, I try to go into the ancient culture. It doesn't matter which country. The one it got into my eye, that's the one I pick. Just trying to show what it was, how it began, or the best part. Like right now, I'm working in a piece from Brazil, okay? Because I like the colors that the indigenous has in his head. So it mainly cultural aspect, historical. Someone called historical. I don't know if it's the right name to apply, but well, I'm using it.
What are some of the influences in your work and the media in which you work?
Well, I work in acrylic media, mixed media, which I'm not afraid to use anything, okay? Anything that I think could be applied or seen good. And how affects, well, I think it can show the people. My paintings can be touched, you know, they're not like museum pieces.
You like people to touch your paintings?
Some of them, yes, because they can feel the texture. Let's say if I'm working in a statue, they can touch it because it has rocks, it has sand, it has something that makes you feel what you're seeing.
Josefina Monson-Giesinger is one of the artists in the Santa Fe Art Institute Open Studios happening a week from today, Thursday of next week. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Julia Barbosa Landois, another resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us about the work that you're working on. It looks like you do multimedia installations.
I do. I do installation, live performance, which is often incorporated somehow into the installation environment, and some video objects that make up the environment as well. Yeah, so kind of all over the place.
What are some of the themes that you're working with?
Well, I'm embarking on a new project here, which is combining a lot of media that I work with, video, performance, and trying to make a performance that will correspond with a projected video, which is something that I've never done before. Works on paper that will comprise some of the animation in the video, and in an installation environment. So a lot of this is referencing the landscape a little bit, and then also things like border tourism for sex and exotic game hunting. I'm from South Texas, and so that's very much part of the culture there. And
exotic game hunting?
Mm-hmm.
Like what?
Some of them you could call them canned hunts, which is they're a closed off ranch area, and people bring in exotic African antelope and animals like that, and then they take you out on hunting parties to kill these animals.
That they brought in is maybe a step up from shooting fish in a barrel or something?
Well, I feel that way. This also sometimes corresponds then with you culminate the night in going to a border town and kind of going crazy and that sort of a thing.
And so when people do that, I mean, have you witnessed these events, so to speak?
I have not. I know people who have been, and part of my project is sourced from transcribed interviews. Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah, so I would think the culture of that is something that's easy to judge or feel that it's like a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about it?
Well, particularly with things like going to border towns to party or to experience sex work and things like that, I think there's a lot of work out there that portrays the desperation and portrays the side of Mexico and the side of maybe the women who are sex workers, but doesn't really address what's behind the appetite that creates a place like that. What is the place of the people who don't have to live there, who can go and then feel like they can leave everything that they did behind, and the mythology of a place that doesn't have to be a border town, but it could also be Las Vegas or New Orleans during Mardi Gras, and this place that it's kind of a depository for this extreme that you do, and you kind of let it all out and go crazy, and then you feel like it's washed away, at least when you can
What happens in Vegas?
Right. Right.
So you do performances that address this whole set of appetites, as you put it.
Well, my previous performances have not. This is a new project, but there is a lot about the body and people's feelings about it, and conflicting things about discomfort or decay, or how that relates to gender and sexuality and stuff like that.
Are you performing yourself or using your body in the performances?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are you? What are you doing?
Yeah, well, the last one I did, it was very casual. I was serving this cake that was overflowing with all of this stuff inside of it. And so I was playing the part of the very gracious hostess at the opening. And so really interacting with people, but not necessarily how I would if I were being myself. And then a project that I did at a solo show about a year ago, I interacted with people only with my eyes. I was in this glass coffin sort of structure with mice. And I lay there for about 2.5 hours and seemed to be unmoving. But when people would come close, I would engage them with my eyes. And that was a really interesting experience, because some people would automatically look away and back off and feel very uncomfortable with that. And some people would laugh because they were nervous. And some people would just stand there and engage me, and and we'd kind of lock that way for a few minutes. It was great.
Amazing. It must have been hard to lie still for that long too.
It was not so bad. I think with any kind of performance, you have to know how to get into this meditative mindset of how you're going to empty yourself out and act a part, or you know, keep your body still or keep it moving in a very controlled way. And so I just try to take a deep breath and get in the right frame of mind and do it.
Julia Barbosa-Landois is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Carl Cronin. He's another artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. You are a video and movement artist.
That's right. Yeah.
Artist who works with plants, perhaps animals.
That's right.
The natural world.
Tell us about your work. Yeah. I'm embarking on a new project. It's to embody the presence and the being of the natural world. I call it an embodied archive of the natural history of the United States. And so it's a very ambitious, large-scale vision that I have, but I'm taking it one day at a time. And I do a practice where I go out each day, and I work in different locations, different habitats, and I apply a series of methods I've developed called experiential geography, where I look at being in the space, mimicking, mirroring the contour, shape, movement of a plant or an animal or geological formation. And what I'm looking to do is create a distillation of what I found that I can hold in my body, so an embodied memory of that space. And then I share that in a weekly offering, public offering that I do, sort of like a little menagerie or a series of tableaus of where I've been that week. And it's a way of translating spaces into other spaces and building a physical memory of the world as opposed to just maybe a descriptive memory or cognitive memory, or you know, memory that you build from knowing facts and figures. It's a felt memory of where I've been.
So if you are doing a, what did you call it, a natural history of a redwood forest, through movement,
yep,
you would go sit in the redwood or stand or move in the redwood forest and try to move or feel like a redwood?
Yeah, I think in some ways I give myself tasks to do that are maybe just something I can begin with. Maybe look at the girth of this redwood in front of me. How would I move if I had girth like that? Maybe just as a moving creature, I would maybe explore movement, whereas the redwood would stay stationary.
Or maybe not totally
stationary. Or maybe not totally, and it falls, or if it's growing.
Yeah, or just has micro-movements.
Exactly, micro-movements. And so part of that is, that's a great question, too, about how do you begin. Sometimes it's just picking an orientation. Maybe in that case I would stay, you know, Carl Cronin the size that I am, redwood the size that it is, or maybe I would change scale. Maybe I would try to imagine that I'm working on a more micro level of like, let me join up with this tree at the root level and move at the pace of maybe 1 minute for me is 100 minutes for the tree, and how would that movement exist over time? So when I'm in this space, I tend to do what my imagination can let me do and what I can explore physically. And then when I leave the space, I do a bunch of just research. I have a couple geographers I work with that help me figure out, fill in the gaps of things I can't see. How does root growth work? How does cellular growth work? So that I can fill in the gaps from what I thought might be happening with what really is happening.
There was an amazing woman named Julia Butterfly Hill who lived in a tree for 2 years, and her relationship to trees changed radically because she knew them and understood them and felt them as kind of co-habitants of the forest rather than as something different from her.
Right.
That took a long time. Do you get yourself into a place where... I mean, do you stay in a place long enough where that happens to you?
I do. I tend to go back to sites again and again each day. And when I'm there, I try to do a mixture of focus time where I have a task and I'm working on something, and then sort of diffuse focus time where I'm just there and just being there. And I feel like what I offer in my offerings has as much to do with the architecture that I've created in these distillations as it does the... permeation of the being there that comes through from all the time I spent there. I mean, so much of the history we tell of where we were comes through our eyes, our muscles, our bones. They hold the story, even if we don't even know what story we're holding. And so I think just the ritualized aspect of the work that I do creates that kind of being that can come through. Because I go back to the same site every day, spend time ruminating on it between times, and over the course of months, I sort of accumulate a knowledge of a particular space.
So how many, I mean, if you stay in a place for months, it's going to take you a long time to do the whole United States.
Yes. And I like this idea of the impossible task, taking on the impossible task. I recently found that there's, and I don't know much about it, but there's sort of a Buddhist saying 10,000 things, which is a way to describe the phenomenal world. And so I've given my task, myself the task of documenting 10,000 things, whether they be plants, animals, locations. And I did the calculation this week that if I do 4 a week, which is my current rate, it'll take me 50 years to complete this cycle. And so I've got a long road ahead of me to complete it, and I like the idea of taking that kind of task on, long-term thinking, long-term experience, long-term process.
So how do you give that to other people? What are the media in which they experience
yeah.
it?
The weekly offerings are a performance offering where I use text, song, movement, and sometimes other sensory inspiring material like smells from the place or some of the material they can smell and touch. I also have a video process where I distill what I've been working on both in the environment and outside the environment that I show in a sort of two-channel video exhibition. And I have a lot of sketches and drawings of me processing how to do this and what I'm working on that I share in an installation fashion. And I've got a handbook called the Experiential Geography Handbook that I'm working on, which will show people how to use some of these methods that I use to encounter their world and start to create their own embodied archive. So that's, I guess those are the media that I'm working on.
I find it fascinating that you are based in New York City, which has less nature per square inch than most places.
It's true. Yeah, I feel like it's been a great place to grow the conceptual understanding of how to approach this work. It's a really heady environment because it's so densely cultured. So there's a lot of interest in what's going on in the natural world. So I think it's created the appetite that I use to propel myself out of the city. I go out of the city a lot to different locations, and it's a great place to get me hungry again to go out into the world.
If people want to find out more about your work, do you have a site?
Yeah, dryearth.org is a place where they can see these videos and the writings and find out more.
Carl Cronin is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and once again, we'll be showing his work along with everybody else Thursday, a week from today, from 5:30 to 7:30. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Michelle Fried. She is a video artist, also an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
So you make videos about subjects such as stomach problems.
Yes.
Your latest video is called Problemas de Estómago, Stomach Problems.
That was actually the Spanish title because it was shown in Spain
November. Oh, okay. Yeah, I see this thing. Okay.
It's actually called Stomach Trouble, and it stars a character who plays me, and she suffers from stomach pains, and she's forced to get a gastric bypass surgery by a charlatan doctor named Dr. Dirk Wilmoth.
Who is a sort of sinister-looking character.
Yes. Actually, I love the idea of using characters or using actors who are non-actors, because in that way they kind of express very dramatic, not well-trained acting abilities. And I think that, I don't know, I have always been into like John Waters and how he uses his friends. These two characters were actually played by people I knew in school, and it was my first time directing, so the acting is very stilted and
on purpose, and has that kind of a, what would you call it, art student, like dark humor camp feel to it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not trained in the world of filmmaking, but as far as my ideas, I feel like the ideas I come from personal experience. And when I write a script or when I approach a topic, it's usually not thinking in terms of film, but how to create a narrative based on the psychology of a story. So, for instance, she has a stomach problem, so the whole world she lives in is dirty and toxic and poisonous and not well-suited for healthy situations, I suppose.
Now, this is somebody else who plays you?
Yes.
Who plays Michelle Free?
Yes.
But you're not actually in the film?
Yes. Everything is kind of dramatized to this, to a unrealistic extent. The person who personifies me exaggerates me. And I asked her to, you know me a little bit. Try and play me for a little while.
It is funny to have somebody to be a director and saying, okay, play me.
Well, I've always been a performance artist. Some of the first videos I've ever done, it was just me trying to create like an anonymous character. And I wanted to get more into topics that were more specific about my experiences. And I realized that to play myself was, it didn't make sense to me. So I wanted to ask someone to play me as a character.
Did you actually have gastric bypass surgery?
No, I did not. But I was reading about speculations of Courtney Love getting a cosmetic gastric bypass surgery. And I thought that was really interesting, the kind of, I guess, the assault that one puts on his or her body in order to meet these expectations of a certain way to look or be.
Part of the greater American pathology, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, and the world that Michelle lives in stomach trouble, is this corrupt world, and it's the kind of world that would allow her to get a compulsory gastric bypass surgery by a charlatan doctor.
So what are you working on now at the Art Institute?
I'm working on a series of animations that have to do with food, and in this instance, I have a hot dog, a hamburger, and SpaghettiOs. And they are personified as like human-like characters who antagonize these giants. And they have this relationship that's, they fight all the time, but the food loves to be eaten.
A little Aqua Teen Hunger Force in there?
I've actually never seen the show before.
Oh, okay.
Perhaps.
Oh, because they're characters that like a milkshake and so on.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are, one's a Big Mac, and they're supposed to be symbols of American culture and consumerism, and the giants are supposed to be these kind of like angry, large beings that are kind of at the mercy of the food. So the food takes advantage of them and teases them and tricks them into doing these things. And it's just a series of vignettes. There's no real narrative that unfolds. It's just these cross sections of actions and situations between the food and the giants.
And people can check out more of Michelle Fried's work at the open studios of the Santa Fe Art Institute's Artist in Residence. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Joy Wood. She is an artist in residence, actually writer in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hi.
So you are writing fiction?
Yes.
What themes are you working on? Are you dealing with in your work?
I'm currently working on a collection of short stories titled 30 Words for Snow, and it's kind of concerning. I would say that my work concerns itself with issues of competing versions of truth and kind of our responsibility to either conceal or reveal those truths in relation to others.
Would you like, you've got a manuscript right in front of you. Why don't you read some of your work and we'll talk from there.
Okay, yes. I'm going to read from the beginning of this story, and it's called The One-Legged Army. The shoes were more important than the girls. Names evaporated like sweat once we left bedrooms, but the shoes stayed with us. More accurately, below us, lining the basement walls of our house. Heels with straps that crisscrossed up the leg. Jelly sandals like piles of hardened spaghetti. Knee-high pleather boots from our chemistry lab partners cutting loose for the weekend. Rubber slides with nubby massaging insoles from the soccer players whose thighs made swish-swish noises in nylon shorts. Up close, you could see how the shoes had hurt their owners. There'd be a tongue of dried blood lining the heel, gray squiggles of rubbed off skin caked on the insole. We took one shoe from each girl, enough to remember her by, but not enough to make her hate us later. Or so we thought. With 24 of us in the fraternity, the shoes accumulated quickly. Nailed sole first to the walls in rows, they looked as though they were forever circling an invisible drain. accidentally brush against them, and specks of glitter would float down to join the beery dust on the linoleum floor. In the late afternoon sun, the shoes shone like skulls. It was like having our own private museum of natural history. Whenever we had a party, we put a contractor-grade padlock on the basement door to protect our collection. Marty liked to smell the shoes, so we called him Fet, short for fetish. The name was Ronnie's idea. He was the house president. A sixth-year senior, he always wore shorts, even in winter, when he would switch to heavier fabric, tweed or wool. He used a red cotton belt with a shiny pill-shaped buckle to hold them up. His beard was starting to gray at the corners of his mouth. It wasn't difficult to imagine him lurking at the edges of an elementary school playground, his pockets sagging with lollipops. I never knew why we decided to take shoes instead of bras or panties, which were more likely to be surrendered by their owners, less likely to be noticed as missing after the fact. But as a new brother, I didn't want to ask dumb questions. It was satisfying to look at the shoes anyway. Row after row of their hard bits and hollows, like an ear of corn after you're done eating. If girls could keep shit like dried corsages and valentines from middle school boyfriends, why couldn't we keep something for ourselves? I couldn't imagine what girls would save from us. Condom wrappers, hair. Ronnie once slept with a girl rumored to be into witchcraft. When I would see her around campus, she was always wearing something made of crushed velvet. I guess Ronnie saw potential behind the trappings, but he told me she was a one-timer, something to satisfy your curiosity. He swore to me she'd clip his fingernails while he was passed out. "Look at it this way, Nick," Ronnie said. "They get something. We get something. No worries." Even though he was a kinesiology major, I believed him.
Joy Wood, from a collection of short stories. Now, you're looking at truth from multiple perspectives. Do you then have some of these same narratives from another character's perspective?
No. All of my stories are kind of told from a different character's point of view. They're not linked in any way, so they kind of shift location and theme.
What did you have to do to get yourself into a frat boy's head?
It's interesting because I never, you know, in my undergrad college, Vassar doesn't have a Greek system, so I had to really kind of think about, you know, like the young men I would see on campus and try and picture myself, like what would my life be like if I were one of them, and how would I react to these things, and like how would I describe, you know, a night out with my friends, and it's something completely removed from my own experience, but it's really interesting and fun to write.
What are some of the other characters that you're developing in this series of stories?
I have both male and female protagonists. I have, you know, young women growing up in families in New York.
Are you from New York?
No, I'm not, but I lived there for a bit after college. And there are also stories set in Michigan, which is my native state, and so kind of things that deal with what a unique Michigan experience is.
To hear more of Joy Wood's work, the Open Studios at the Santa Fe Art Institute, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like now to welcome Artist in Residence Sean Hall from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So you are a painter from New Orleans, is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
So tell us about what you're working on right now.
What I'm working on at the Santa Fe Institute, Art Institute, is not clear, actually, yet. I'm just kind of trying to open some things up for myself. I mean, I've been working pretty hard the last couple of years and in a particular direction, and I'm kind of still following that, but I'm trying to experiment a little bit more. So still paintings and some photography.
There have been a lot of artists from New Orleans at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Mm-hmm. What has been your experience? Were you there before, during, and after Hurricane Katrina?
I was. I wasn't there during because we evacuated, but I was there right after, as soon as the power came back on, which was 2 months. I was back. Yeah.
What was your experience like there, and how did it find its way into your work?
Well, I don't really know that it found its way into my work specific in terms of subject matter. I think how it found its way into my work is that because I was gone for 2 months and I was, you know, I was staying at different people's houses, and I couldn't really work. I had bought a camera right before not for I really don't know why I bought it, but so I had a camera and I started taking photographs, and then I ended up buying some watercolors because I couldn't work anywhere, so I started doing these
little... Because you'd lost your studio.
I lost my studio. Well, I hadn't lost it, but I couldn't go back to it, and I was there was no place to work. So I started doing these little watercolors, and then I ended up getting a residency at the LMCC, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which was kind of a Gulf Coast relief thing. For 7 months, I was in New York, kind of back and forth, New Orleans, New York, and they don't, you know, I've been a big, sloppy, wet oil painter forever, and, you know, you just can't do that. So in public place spaces, nobody likes it. So I ended up...
Why, because of the smell?
Yeah, because of the fumes. And it's, you know, it's not the healthiest thing, and the way I paint is not the healthiest thing. So I ended up trying acrylics and kind of being interested in them. And so I'm pretty much still a very wet painter. I use them, like a lot of times people think that my acrylics look like watercolors and that my watercolors look a little bit more like oil or something, like they're pretty thick and, you know. So I'm kind of still sort of fooling around with that medium. And that's how really it affected me, is that it changed.
If you're a wet painter and you're mm-hmm. using acrylics in Santa Fe, they dry really fast.
Sort of. It depends on how much water you use. They don't, you know. I mean, I'm working on the floor. Right now, I mean, when I was an oil painter, I was really, really seriously wet, drippy. You know, I'd really control the viscosity, but the wetter it was, the better for me. Now, I've been really kind of interested in the sort of transparency and the sort of, you know, controlling kind of... just the movement of it. So I'm sort of engaged in that process. Like sometimes I'm painting and drawing, other times I'm just like letting things kind of flow, and I have to do that on the floor, and it takes a long time. I can use a lot of water, I mean, and they just sort of sit there, and if I want them to, you know, they'll, if I put them up, they'll, you know, they take sometimes a couple hours to dry here.
Even if you put them on the wall?
No, if I put them on the wall, they just run off.
Okay.
You know, but...
So working flat helps you control...
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I'm sort of on the wall, on the floor, whatever works for how I want.
Talk more about your subject matter.
Well, the subject matter has changed a lot over the last probably 8 years. And now it's pretty much firmly in the natural world and it kind of... I'm sort of reimagining... biology and botany and kind of life processes, you know. So I'm not really, sometimes I'm looking at really specific things and, you know, thinking about them and copying them, but a lot of times I'm making up, I'm sort of engaged in the natural world, I feel like, kind of imagining that and thinking about that in kind of a reverent way. I mean, I think I went from sort of more politically based work about our society and about culture to things that I feel more akin with and more reverent towards, which is nature and kind of the wonder of nature.
Sean Hall is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and once again, the open studios are happening a week from today, Thursday, the 24th of September, from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can call 424-5050 or you can go to sfai.org. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz.